calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, it's so much in the news. It's really quite remarkable. The mayor of Salt Lake City out there saying, you know, we've had enough. We've had enough. And a lot of speakers, a substantial number of speakers coming out and speaking out also at this rally in Salt Lake City against George W. Bush and against the war. What's the paper here? I think this is the Salt Lake Tribune. Yes, it is. The Salt Lake Tribune. A crowd of thousands cheered Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson. Gee, there's another Rocky there. For calling President Bush, quote, a dishonest, warmongering, human rights violating president whose time in office would rank as the worst presidency our nation has ever had to endure. Wow. Pull a few punches there, Rocky. The group, the Salt Lake City paper, goes on to say, this is an article by Heather May and Christopher Stewart in the Salt Lake Tribune. The group included children and elderly and some hailing from throughout Utah, then marched to the federal building Wednesday to deliver a copy of a symbolic indictment against the president and Congress for abuse of power and failure to uphold the U.S. Constitution. Bush in Salt Lake City today, and here we have the mayor of Salt Lake City saying,
in 2003, my two sons were in the Arizona National.
Here, let me start this over again. This is a clip, by the way. There's a number of pieces of audio over on the website. This is Joe Sear of he's an Iraq War veteran. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Aaron Davis. Pardon me. 18-year veteran of the United States military. His name is Aaron Davis, and he was just speaking at the conference or speaking at the rally, Salt Lake City. Didn't have to go to a free speech zone. Police didn't herd him in because the mayor said, "Nah, you're not going to have that."
In 2003, my two sons were in the Arizona National Guard and got activated for Iraq. So at that point, I became I've been sort of an activist anyway, a peace and justice activist. But now we organize things like this to tell people, first of all, our Chapter 118 Veterans for Peace mission is to educate the public on the human costs of war and to help heal the warrior. And we do that not only speaking out, but leading marches. We have workshops. We talk to veterans. I do GI rights counseling and veterans outreach. A lot of veterans are homeless.
Explain the difference between protesting President Bush's visit and supporting troops and protesting the war, supporting the troops.
Okay, and many people have difficulty distinguishing because of that dualistic way of thinking. So the bottom line is, here in Utah, I say I support the troops, but I don't support the war, because the war, number one, was based on wrong information, wrong intelligence.
Lies.
We are really not there to liberate the Iraqi people. We're not there to spread democracy. We're simply there to expand American capitalism and to make sure that we control the world supply of oil. And that's the bottom line. We have forward operating bases, permanent bases, actually 14 of them in Iraq right now. And so if we're supporting a war on terrorism, I would certainly question all of the things that the U.S. government's doing.
This in the conservative Salt Lake Tribune. Salt Lake City, I mean, this is one of the most conservative cities in the United States. Orrin Hatch has all this publicity, all this, you know, favorable ratings, and it's incredible. Here, Bush shows up in Utah. And, you know, and I'll set aside the polygamous jokes. Yeah, they got Warren Jess, but in any case, Bush shows up in Utah, and, I mean, traditionally, the Mormons who dominate the political scene there are conservative Republicans. In fact, here in Oregon, Gordon Smith, a Mormon. You got Mitt Romney from Massachusetts, a Mormon who may well be the Republican nominee for president in 2008. He's got rolling in his direction. And and the mayor of the city saying, nah, nah. We're Mayor Rocky Anderson. We're not going to go along with this. This is just wrong. This is just absolutely wrong. We're not going to put up with it. It ain't right. It ain't right. 1,500 protesters. Signs labeling Bush, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld the axis of evil. Well, that's a nice reframe. Here's another one.
All week trying to figure out whether to make a sign against the war.
This is retired librarian Judy Lord, just a average citizen there in Salt Lake City.
Whether to make a sign saying please recognize global warming. There are just so many things that I feel bad about this administration. Please support our Constitution. Just, I had to be here.
Yeah, what an idea. And I suspect that particularly if the mainstream media will pick up this story and run with it, which I'm suspicious of or wary of or doubtful is the word. I'll be really frankly surprised if this becomes a big national story, simply because the mainstream media is largely in the business of sucking up to the Bush administration because they don't want to lose access to the Bush administration, and they don't want to be outed, and they don't want to be imprisoned, and all those awful things that the Bushies do to their political enemies, and they know about that. But with their signs labeling Bush Secretary of State, this from Salt Lake Tribune, Bush Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, the axis of evil, calling the Iraq War a mission of lies, or comparing the invasion of Iraq after 9/11 to invading Mexico after Pearl Harbor. That's a pretty good analogy. The estimated 1,500 to 4,000 protesters hoped their demonstration at the Salt Lake City County building sent a message about the reddest state in the country. The Reverend Tom Goldsmith of the First Unitarian Church in Salt Lake City. He says if they, the Bush administration, lack support in Utah, my God, they're in trouble. For those who couldn't get enough, organizers held a Rock Against Rumsfeld concert at Pioneer Park in the evening. Between songs, Salt Lake City singer Colin Robinson challenged Rumsfeld's Tuesday speech to the American Legion. Robinson said to the crowd of over 300, critics of the war were equated with Nazi sympathizers? How dare he? What about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay? Who's the Nazi? The mother of an Iraqi war veteran on his second tour, Debbie Johnson, told the crowd that they need not hear the Orwellian doublespeak. I mean, this is just amazing. The average people getting out there and just speaking out, saying, you know, we've had enough. And this in Salt Lake City, in the reddest city, in the reddest state in the entire United States, people standing up to George W. Bush and saying, enough already. Enough already. Debbie Johnson.
I'm here to support the troops, the sailors and Marines and soldiers.
I noticed you have a flag. Does that represent anybody in particular?
Yeah, my husband's in the Marine Corps.
And where's he stationed?
We just moved here, actually. He's working with the reservists. He's been to Iraq twice. Yeah, he's been to Kuwait. Yeah. Everybody has, you know, a right to their opinion. You know, our president's made mistakes, but he's our president, and I respect him, and we have the best country in the world, and I'm proud to be an American.
So it's interesting. This is a rally where there's all different views being represented. That's Heather Cope. She's the wife of a Marine. And, you know, speaking out, saying, well,
I'm here to support the troops, the sailors and Marines.
She's there to support the troops, not necessarily the president, right? Because this is an anti-Bush rally. I just find this absolutely fascinating, what's going on in Salt Lake City. It's in a way, it's sort of, you know, Lopez Obrador down in Mexico. The election has been given to his opponent, Calderon, and you know, what's he going to do? Are we going to see civil disobedience in Mexico? Big piece in the Wall Street Journal about this today, the New York Times. Everybody's, you know, what's next? What's next? Well, I'm wondering what's next in the United States. We've got this huge rally that's planned for the 5th of October, and actions coming up in September. WorldCan'tWait.org, WorldCan'tWait.net for all the information on that. It's just earlier in the day, Anderson started going hoarse while speaking. This at the Salt Lake City, Utah. This we're talking about Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City. He started going hoarse while speaking, often yelling to the anti-Bush throng for 35 minutes. At times, his message strayed from the anti-war theme to criticism of federal policies on illicit drugs, global warming, tax cuts, and Hurricane Katrina. I mean, it's really all part of the same thing. These the Republicans in power today believe that all things can be accomplished by giving more wealth and power to large institutions, to major corporations, and the wealthy people in the United States, and solving all social problems by killing people, whether it's capital punishment in the states or whether it's war externally. And it just doesn't work. And it's coming back to haunt us. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I remember when this was a two-paper town. A big company came in, shut one of them down. Seems now all you get is one point of view. And it don't really matter which side you're on, 'cause nobody wins when our choices are gone. Both sides of a story often lead to the truth.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. What has the GOP done for workers recently? What has it done for any of us recently? Clint Gold writes in the Tulsa World, he says, not long ago, my wife and I attended a TV, and by the way, this is all part of the whole, right? It really and truly is all part of the whole. The war policy, let's protect our oil, let's make sure Exxon Mobil has record profits. By the way, I'm seeing, we've been having a contest here over in the chat or over in the message board for some time about what will be the October surprise? We do this every 2 years. What will be the October surprise that the Bushies will pull out of the hat this time? And in 2004, of course, it was all the terror alerts. Every time the Republicans got a little traction, there was a terror alert. And in 2000, of course, it was ginning up for the war. Oh, we got weapons of mass destruction. That was the October surprise. What's it going to be this time? A lot of folks suspecting that it's going to be gasoline going down to $2 a barrel, or $2 a gallon, rather. And Americans will just kind of forget about their pain, and they'll go back to sleep. And by the way, that would probably be a really good time to buy oil or gas stocks, because then right after the elections, wham, they'll get us. So, the protests in Salt Lake City, and we'll be getting back to that and to your calls on that as well in just a few minutes. And what the greedy oil party, the GOP, has done for workers, what they've done for America, what is happening to America in the hands of Republican control. Clint Gold wrote this. Tom in Minneapolis sent it to me. Thank you, Tom. And it's just it's a brilliant piece. It was originally published in Tulsa World a couple of years ago. He says, not long ago, my wife and I attended a TV football party in South Tulsa. With a lopsided score, conversation turned to a livelier subject, politics. The crowd was, of course, top-heavy with Republicans. With each point expressed, their eyes became more flushed. Their faces became more flushed, eyes bulging a little more, and veins popping in their foreheads as they railed against the liberal programs. Finally, a lone liberal voice asked, and see, this is the question I asked Tom Tancredo on this program back, it must have been 4 years ago. Back when we were syndicated on iAmerica Radio. I had him on, the conservative Republican from Colorado. And I said, Congressman Tancredo, can you please name for me one piece of legislation that your party, since it's controlled the House and Senate, that your party has put through and that your president, your Republican president, has signed into law that had as its primary beneficiary, we the people and not a corporation? And he said, the ban on abortion. And I said, I'm not sure that there would be a consensus that we were the beneficiaries of that. I mean, just something that helped us out. And he thought for a while, and he says, I can't come up with one. So we had a contest. We actually ran the contest for 2 years. I gave away, your choice of one of my books. If anybody could name one piece of legislation that the Republicans came up with, the Republicans passed, that actually benefited people more than corporations. Nobody was able to do it. Ultimately, we had one piece, as I recall. But then when we dug into it, we discovered, oh, there was a gotcha in there, too. So anyhow, as Clint Gold is ready, finally a lone liberal voice said, will you people name me one bill your party has ever passed to help the working man in this country? And none of the Republicans in the room, of course, could answer. So finally one of them said, well, what have the Democrats done? And as the liberal responded, he spoke of FDR's New Deal programs, the father of modern liberalism, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Peace Corps, unemployment insurance, welfare programs for the poor, civil rights, student grants and loan programs, safety laws, environmental laws, prevailing wage laws, the right to collectively bargain, to have paid medical insurance, to have paid vacations and pensions, the five-hour work week, or the five-day work week, rather, the 40-hour work week, workers' compensation, the Marshall Plan, flood disaster insurance, school lunch programs, women's rights, the Fair Labor Standards Act. All of these things were passed by liberals over the objection of conservatives. FHA, HUD housing, public housing, urban renewal, 44 million residential homes. Keep in mind, before World War II, 70% of our nation were renters. By the 1970s, that had been reversed. Farm conservation subsidies, USDA programs, protecting our food, protecting our farmers, the FHA, the Farmers Home Administration, because the bankers didn't want to make rural loans, small flood control lakes, more than 3,000 in Oklahoma alone. Keep in mind, this was in the Tulsa paper. Rural water districts, electricity into rural areas. The big power companies said, hey, it's not profitable. So Franklin Roosevelt said, you're going to do it anyway. Created the REA. The GI Bill was passed. The Republicans bitterly opposed to this so that people like my father could go to college after they got out of the military. They thought, oh, all these returning veterans, cheap labor. 8 million people use college benefits, creating millions of entrepreneurs. All that from the liberals. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I dream of a world where though we're not the same, freedom is more than a word that we say, where you can say what you think and no one would dare put you down. I dream of a world. I dream of a world. I dream of a world that's a two-paper town.
A two-paper town, what a novel idea! Remember the old days? Some of you probably aren't old enough, but there was actually a time in the United States when even small towns, I mean a town of 30, 40,000 people would have two or three newspapers, and you'd get contrasting points of view, and people would have it out. There was actual competition. Everything was locally owned. It was really America. Things have so changed. And, you know, frankly, it's profoundly tragic. The mayor, Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City today at a rally. George W. Bush, of course, taking his roadshow to sell his war. He calls it a war. I call it an occupation. To sell his occupation, his ongoing occupation of Iraq, building 14 bases. We're never going to leave. They got the world's second largest supply of oil. So, you know, it's pretty important that we stay there. I mean, you know, after all, as Cheney says,
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
So here's the mayor of Salt Lake City.
Well, we've brought thousands of people out today, all of us united, regardless of political party, united in opposition to the disastrous direction this president, his administration, and this Congress have taken this country, particularly with regard to the war, the lies that we were told, this war that never should have been commenced in the first place. We were told by our Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, that the war would last 6 days, 6 weeks, probably not 6 months. Everything these people told us turned out not to be the truth. They have no credibility. We need leadership in this country that will stand up, tell the truth, and work as hard for peace as this administration has worked to make war and to create so much hatred and animosity toward our country.
Great. The American Legion is meeting here at the exact same time. What would you like to say to the Legion
Well, if they give me the opportunity, like the Veterans of Foreign Wars did last year, I would tell them that we cannot confuse opposition to our political leaders that have chosen to put our servicemen and servicewomen into harm's way. We can't confuse that opposition, which is so healthy to our democracy, with the question of support for our troops, because we all support our troops. We're all so very grateful to our veterans who have given so much to fight and for and preserve our freedoms. That's what I would tell them. I would tell them, thank you.
Amen. Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City, standing up to George W. Bush as Bush visits his city for a fundraiser and an attempt to hype up support, to amp up support, to get people, we got to get all excited about this war. Oh, boy, we got to get over there and then kill some folks because that'll make the world safer. If we kill a whole bunch of people and get their families all upset with us and get their neighbors all upset with us and their tribes all upset with us and their friends all upset with us, yeah, that's going to make us safer. Yes, indeed. No, it doesn't make sense. No, it doesn't make sense. I'm sorry. It's insane. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, toll free across the United States, all across the United States. There's a pair of headphones there, Lewis, if you want, that works. And Lewis Melmadrona in the studio with us. We'll be talking with him a little later on in the program. Jim in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I'm in Seattle, but I spent a year working in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a really surprising town. It's now less than 50% Mormon. And the part that isn't Mormon is extremely liberal.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, they have a huge gay pride parade. They have big environmental rallies. But basically, Salt Lake City and Park City are very liberal parts of...
Have all the Mormons moved out to, white exurbs or something like that?
Yeah, they've all moved to places like Graper and stuff like that. What they do is they actually build suburbs that have Mormon temples at the center,
right,
and shopping areas and things like that, and they're moving into these, Mormon town community type places.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting, interesting.
And Rocky is a killer guy.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'm getting that. I'm just amazed, Utah is one of the reddest states in the United States. They've got two Republican senators in the Senate. They've got Republican members of the House of Representatives.
They have one Democrat congressman, and he represents Salt Lake City.
I see. Okay.
And then I worked in Bountiful, so I worked with extremely conservative people, and I had great political conversations with them, because it was precious watching their face when you ask them things like, how can you believe in, one of them asked me, why are you a liberal? And I said, because in 20 years I won't be embarrassed by my beliefs today.
Yeah, well, and my answer is because, liberals like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson actually had some pretty good ideas. And I think we ought to, try and play them out. Liberals like Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself and helped build the strongest industrial power in the world. And it just seems to me like you stick with what works. When the conservatives ran this country, we had repeated Republican Great Depressions and panics, all the panics of the 1890s, and it didn't work. And we had wars, and it just didn't work. And when liberals run the country, things works better, life is better. You're more likely to have peace. I mean, it's not rocket science.
Well, if you listen to their position, basically their position is right. If all of the scientists have a liberal bias, all of the judges have a liberal bias, all the media has a liberal bias, and all the historians have a liberal bias.
Right. In other words, reality is not real.
Yeah. Then everything they say works just fine.
There you go. There you go. Jim, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's amazing. Greg in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today?
Hi. No, I just wanted to try to, I guess, give a plug out to a former congressman who was running in District 23 in my district
mm-hmm.
against Congressman Henry Bonilla. And because of the special redistricting, the Supreme Court found it unconstitutional and redistricted District 23, which spans from San Antonio basically to El Paso. And Mr. Rodriguez was looking for some support, and I just wonder if I could give out his email address and their office number.
Probably giving somebody's email address or phone number on the air is not always the best idea, because then you get a lot of spam and crank calls. But if you have a website that you can put out,
Website. It's CIRO D Rodriguez.com. And
is that Rodriguez with a Z or with an S?
Z at the end.
Okay. So say it again.
I'm sorry, sir.
Say it again.
Ciro D Rodriguez, CIRO. Is his first name, and then the middle initials D, and then Rodriguez, RODRIGUEZ.com.
Great.
And it explains everything to his on his website.
And he's a good progressive candidate.
Yes, he's very staunch Democrat. Yes, sir.
Great. Greg, thanks a lot for the heads up. I appreciate it. Mario in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, Mario, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I have to make a little correction what you said on the air yesterday. What's happening is that with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad saying that he wants to wipe Israel off the map, that's not what he said.
No, it's not. He said he wanted to redraw the map.
Yeah, exactly. Not only that, Ron Kohl, his exact words were he wanted to wipe away from the pages of time the regime. He wants to overthrow the government. That's what he wants.
Yeah.
And what's been happening is that came in from the Times.
Although that may be a distinction which is not of great consequence.
I know. But the thing is, there's no idiom for wipe off the face of the map.
Yeah. He's playing to his base. I mean, it's like George W. Bush saying he's going to kill all the terrorists. He's just playing to his base.
I know he's playing to his base. But the thing is that the Times has not corrected it. Now, in Europe, they've got it right. They got the translation correctly. That's why Kofi Annan is going to Iran right now to meet with him.
Right.
Because at first he thought that's what he had said, wipe him off the map.
Yeah.
Basically a genocide. But once he got the corrected translation, he decided to visit him.
Yeah, but Fox News hasn't gotten the corrected translation.
No, they have not.
The Republican Party has not gotten the corrected translation. And here's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad saying, you know, he's debating Bush to a debate. Mm-hmm. But really the undertow or the what is not stated, the subtext of that, is he's inviting Bush to discuss things, to talk with him.
Exactly.
I mean, yesterday, by the way, was the anniversary of the date in 1963, or maybe it was 53. I'd have to go back and find this day in history. Do you remember, David? You guys pulled it out yesterday. It was either 53 or 63. I think it was 63. Was the anniversary of the day that we installed the continuously operating hotline between Washington, D.C. and Moscow, where the phone was, you didn't have to dial a number or anything. All you had to do was just pick it up, and somebody on the other end would pick it up and go, oh, you want to talk to Gorbachev or you want to talk to Khrushchev? Here he is. You want to talk to Kennedy? Here he is. I mean, that, it was like, oh, we've got an enemy. He's evil. We talked to him. What a novel idea, right? It prevented World War for 50 years. What a novel idea. And Bush, oh, we've got an enemy. We don't talk to him. Well, what are you going to do then? You know, sit around and scratch your butt? I mean, what are you going to do? Oh, we're not going to talk to him, I'll tell you that. I'm going to go bike riding. I'm going to go clear brush. There are more important things to do in the world. You know, kill some people. Yeah. So, Mario, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Don in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I've always been supporting Bush with the aspects of the war, but I've been hearing some things, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, but I thought I'd ask you. I'm told that if we bring a democracy to Iraq,
hey Don,
people...
Don, hang on just a second. I'm sorry, I missed the break cue here, and we have hard breaks in this program. The machine starts and I can't stop it. So let me just put you on hold. We'll pick this up on the other side, okay? I'm usually pretty good about that, but I must not have heard it. My apologies. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The latest news has struck me funny. It's all about greed, boys, and it's all about money.
Well, this great nation is in distress. I've got to get something off of my chest. November's coming and it won't be long. When you cast your vote, please don't vote wrong. Vote away those blues, Republican blues.
Yes. Get ready for November, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Well, coming up to 9 hours. 9 minutes before the hour here. On the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting for a Change here in America. 1-866-440-8466. And Iris in Latano, Florida. Hey, Iris.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, your points that you were making before, what the Democrats and liberals have done to this country is well taken. You're preaching to the choir. We all know that. Why doesn't that information get into the newspapers and the news magazines?
Well, this was common knowledge in the United States 30 years ago, but then Reagan came along and essentially said anything government does is bad. I mean, you know, he began the process of essentially declaring war on American democracy.
Why don't we get off point of view into the newspapers, into the local newspapers if it has to be?
Because the newspapers are no longer locally owned and they no longer have labor pages. Iris, I'm sorry. You gotta turn your radio off. Because the reason, very simply, is because the newspapers are no longer locally owned and they no longer have labor pages in them. They no longer even talk about labor. I mean, you've got, you know, major strikes. There's labor issues going on all over the United States. There's big debates in labor. You've got the split between the Change to Win Coalition and the AFL-CIO. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that has to do with the working people of America. And, you know, 90-some-odd percent of Americans, or the American, workforce, not including, children and elderly people and all that, but you look at the American workforce, 90% of them are working for a living. I mean, there's only a very small percentage of people who are CEOs or who are investors for a living or who live on inherited wealth. It's a very small percentage. And so why is it that we have a business section of the paper every day? Well, for those folks who make their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive. But we don't have anything for people who work any longer. Well, could it have to do with the fact that the newspapers are now owned by big multinational corporations that are run by a bunch of millionaires who want to read the business news? Yeah, I think it may well be. Mike in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
Apropos to what you were just saying about the newspapers, I a few years back, I owned a company that provided subscriptions to a lot of the East Coast papers, Inquirer, New Jersey Star Ledger, all of them. We were actually the largest subscription getter for these papers, and I actually had to let it go after Bush took over, and it was just too much for me politically I couldn't conscience-wise do it. We're talking $1 million a year revenue.
Wow.
Company, yeah. And,
wow. Because the papers have become so right-wing, or because the readership was dropping off, or what?
Well, no, our demand, my company's demand kept going up because they keep losing subscribers to online folks and whatnot. Yeah. And I'm doing a few other things that are not as lucrative, but a little more better for my conscience. A couple comments. Well, I like what you were saying about the Salt Lake City thing, but on a slightly different topic. One is there's two people I listen to on Air America. You and another person I won't mention, who may have been let go.
Yeah.
And
for the record, I honestly know nothing about that. So we'll just stop that conversation right there.
You don't need to comment.
I really don't know anything about it.
You don't need to comment.
Yeah.
But I'm finding it frustrating all over the place. In terms of trying to get to get organized. I was a few weeks ago. I was getting some networking done with some people in different chat rooms, Powers and Morrison, I'm sure you've heard of, Horn Chat, your chat room, different things. And I emailed you a few weeks ago out of concern. For some reason, I'm not sure why, I've lost contact with several people in the chat room. I was expelled from the chat room. I can't get back on for some reason.
Yeah,
is there a way to get back on there?
You're talking about my chat room?
Yeah.
Yeah, send an email to Sue or to me. I just don't, I don't know, and I don't want to get into discussions of what's going on in the chat room here on the air. It's a whole, Joe in Provo, Utah. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm fine. What's up, Joe?
Well, I really love when you touch on the Constitution, the framers, and really kind of elucidate all of what was happening there. And so I've picked up a copy of the Constitution and been studying it. But I also came across, and I'm wanting to know what you think about it if you're familiar with it, the Heritage Foundation, which is kind of that right-wing think tank group.
Yes, I've spoken there a few times. I've debated conservatives there a few times, actually.
Have you? Well, they put out a Heritage Guide to the Constitution. And
oh, no.
Well, I picked it up, and I got to tell you, you know, I don't know that they did. I was wondering if you've read it. It's.
I haven't. Is it pretty straightforward?
It is very straightforward. It blows me away.
Oh, that's good.
It brings home to me, as the way they do it, basically, it brings home the fact that trees are not, how did Gonzalez put it, quaint documents. They're the supreme law of the land.
Yeah, treaties, well, it's written right into the Constitution. Treaties actually supersede the law of the land with very few exceptions.
Is there another guide that you think of that does, because they take it clause by clause, and they use the Federalist Papers, they use Madison's commentaries, and they use Judge Story as their reference, and they've got Edward Meese is the one that kind of spearheaded it, but they brought a whole bunch of people on from all over the country, scholars and stuff, to take each clause and do something with it.
You know, I just don't know. I'll have to check it out. And frankly, I don't know of a good progressive version of the same, and there probably should be one. Maybe I should write it. I don't know. Joe,
yeah,
thanks for the heads up on that.
$35, and I got to tell you, it blew me away. I expected it to be very slanted, and I have found that it's not really slanted.
Although sometimes the slant is so subtle, you know, it's just you just don't know. But Joe, thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. Get ready for a heated exchange with conservative Alan Reinach on the separation of church and state. Coming up next after the break, Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, should the Quran be posted in our public places? The Bhagavad Gita? The Ten Commandments? The Sermon on the Mount? How do we pick? Alan Reinach is with us. He's with churchstate.org. An attorney, minister, and spokesperson for the Workplace Religious Freedom Coalition. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I love your introductory question.
I got an answer for it?
Well, do we get to vote? Is it by majority vote? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. The Constitution pretty much says that the business of government is government and the business of churches is religion.
I have said that many, many times, and I wish the American people would get it. I think we're going to talk about an Idaho Supreme Court decision that said the people get to vote on whether to put the Ten Commandments back up in the park.
And your position on this?
The court was wrong. I don't have any objection, per se, to the commandments being in the park. So I'll start right there. I do have a big problem with making religion a matter of public vote. That we don't vote on whether Jesus is a Messiah, and we don't vote on whether Islam is a religion of peace or not, and we don't vote on which version or whether to display the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, well said. And I'd come into this thing assuming that you were going to be taking the position that we need to be having more religion in the public work in the public arena. You're not?
Well, you know. Our other website is called writteninheheart.org because as a minister, what I recognize is the real need is that we need more religion in our heart. We need it in our hearts. We don't need to put it up on the walls, which is not necessarily hypocrisy to display it. It's hypocrisy if we display it and we don't live it. But the real, you know, rubber meets the road is what's in our hearts, what's in our life.
Oh, this is essentially what Jesus was saying. You're saying yes to the pledge, but no to the Pledge Restoration Act over on your website at churchstate.org. What does that mean?
Well, again, see, we're not battling either for or against references to God in our public life because we think it's a misplaced battle either way. We don't think that the future of religious liberty in America depends upon whether we recite the pledge and say one nation under God or not. As a legal matter, I think it's pretty much a done deal that the courts are not taking God's name out of the pledge, and I think legally that's the right decision. We can get into that. But clearly, the Pledge Protection Act would really tinker with the First Amendment and would effectively nullify the Establishment Clause that says that religion is not the business of government.
Mm-hmm. Now, in his book, So Help Me God, former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, Roy Moore, you wrote this, Liberty Magazine.
Well, I wrote an article critical of Moore's basic premise, because I take it seriously. I don't, I don't just dismiss Roy Moore. He's very serious and intent on his views on the necessity for government to essentially keep the first commandment and to acknowledge God. That's the premise of his whole Ten Commandments movement.
Well, I wanted us to keep all Ten Commandments.
Put
to death children who speak ill of their parents and adulterers and you know.
Well, in his book, he's emphasizing the first. And I say, well, if the state does have an obligation to the first, then why not to the second, third, and fourth? Does this mean that we have to go back to deciding what is heresy, what is blasphemy, what is idolatry? I don't think we want to punish the good people of Texas who turn football into worship, or Wall Street that turns, and many other parts of our society that turn the dollar into an object of idolatrous worship.
So
I'm only being partly tongue-in-cheek here, but, you know, we
no, just I agree with
the
you.
State, this kind of religious authority.
So, Alan Reinach, how do we deal with these people who are essentially theocrats? And Judge Moore, in my opinion, is certainly in that camp, and Scalia as well, and certainly the Bill Frist and the Family Research Council bunch, who essentially say there should be no distinction between church and state, that America was founded on Christian principles, notwithstanding comments by George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and others to the contrary.
I mentioned an official treaty with Tripoli in 1796 stating the otherwise.
Right, yeah, exactly. How do you deal with these people on the right who are saying consistently and constantly that essentially we should become the theocratic nation that the Puritans in the 1600s, who took over Boston, envisioned the country becoming?
That's an awesome question and a very, very difficult one to answer because, you know, I, as a Christian minister, I have ties with many of these groups, and I've had this conversation over and over again with leaders who have these perspectives. It's very hard to shake. I think that the reason I'm doing shows like yours is because I think it's critical that we go to the American people and say, protecting religious freedom and showing respect for the rights of everyone to worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience is consistent with our Constitution. We don't need the state to tell us, who, when, where, why, or how to worship. We're perfectly capable of doing that ourselves, and we don't need religious organizations manipulating the power of the state to promote their religious agenda.
We're talking with Alan Reinach, churchstate.org, his website. He's an attorney, minister, and spokesperson for the Workplace Religious Freedom Coalition. One of the big debates between Jefferson and Madison in the early days, and it's fascinating to read their letters about this, was specifically about the role of religion in the state. Jefferson was convinced, and Jefferson, of course, was a deist. He did not call himself a Christian. In fact, he rewrote the New Testament and took all the miracles out.
Correct.
Still in print, the Jefferson Bible.
Right.
Madison, Madison, on the other hand, called himself a Christian and was probably closest to the Presbyterians. And Madison, his first veto, in office, which was in, 1811, as I recall, in the fall of 1811, his first public veto as president was to veto a bill that gave money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. And he said that he didn't want to do this because he was afraid that if the government started giving money to religious organizations, it would corrupt religion. It would have a corrosive effect on the integrity and purity of religion itself. He didn't want his own Christian religion corrupted. Jefferson, on the other hand, he didn't want that to happen, of course, but his big concern, his big fear, was that the day may come, and in fact it nearly came in 1802, 1803, and it had happened 10 years earlier as well, when Massachusetts would secede from the Union, become a theocracy, and that would become infectious, and we'd end up, throwing America back into the theocracy. I mean, the folks who, they had the revolution in England in the 1500s, where for 7 years the Puritans ran the government, and then finally
Revolution.
Oliver Cromwell, thank you very much, and ran them out of town, and they came here, and they came to Salem and tried to set up their theocracies. Ben Franklin fled Massachusetts because he was tired of seeing women burned and hung in the public square, went to Philadelphia in the early 1700s, and Jefferson was concerned that the religious would take over the government and we'd end up with a theocracy. Madison thought, that's silly. The American people would never put up with that. But he was concerned that if money started being given to the churches, it would corrupt the churches. Now we have a situation in the United States where both of these guys' fears are being realized. We have people in power, Bill Frist and George W. Bush, a whole bunch of them, actually, who are outspoken in saying that religion should be the thing that defines public policy, not unlike the Taliban, not unlike Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And on the other hand, you have also those same people saying that their division of public policy should be shoved down the throat of the religious just in the last year, Bush giving over $1 billion to faith-based initiatives just before the elections. What do we do?
One is, I hope that if the American people contemplate the Taliban and how Sharia law in Islam is implemented in some Islamic countries, that we will learn the lesson that we don't want to go down that same road with Christianity.
Well, and in many ways, it's not that different than what happened under Cromwell. He forbid dancing.
No, of course not. And it's not that different from the church-state arrangements of the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
But the second thing is, in my discussion with black ministers, what I'm finding is increasing concern that the faith-based initiatives and the pouring of money into the black churches has had a corrosive impact and is just short of bribery to try to get an increasing number of the African American voters to vote Republican.
And it worked. In the last election, they doubled. I mean, they went from 5% to 10%, but they doubled the number of African American voters. We're out of time, but an interesting conversation. Alan Reinach, www.churchstate.org for more information. Thanks for being with us, Alan.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Tree-hugging, love-making, pro-choice and gay wedding, widespread digging hippies like me. Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed. We who have nothing, and most likely will till we all end up locked up in jail. By conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American man. Diamonds and dogs, boys and girls, living together in two separate worlds. Following leaders of mountains of shame, looking for someone to blame.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. You're in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Louis Malmadrona is with us in the studio. Louis, an old and dear friend. He's a physician, a psychiatrist, a professor of medicine, You have Lewis. You used to be teaching down at the University of Arizona in Tucson.
Right.
You and Andrew Weil were running the, what was it called, integrative medicine, basically the holistic medicine program down there. And,
right.
And you have since moved up to Canada.
That's right. And Saskatchewan.
Saskatchewan. And you are teaching medicine there, plus you are in practice as a physician.
Right.
And I'm just really curious. You know, I get these right-wingers on all the time and by the way, Lewis is also the author of numerous books. You're Native American. You wrote about Native American healing, coyote wisdom is your latest book.
Right.
And the website for more information on that. Of course, you can find it in any of the book sites. You know, you can go to any of the bookstores and just Google coyote healing or coyote wisdom. Or is there another one, too?
Coyote medicine.
Coyote medicine, of course, the first one.
And then there's a new one, narrative medicine, coming out in July.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And so you can just, you know, find that. Or you go to Lewis's site, which is melmadrona.com, melmadrona.com, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay, cool. So, Lewis, you grew up in the United States. You've seen medicine in the United States from poverty on the reservation to working in New York City at Beth Israel Hospital.
Fifth Avenue.
I mean, you've seen the whole thing.
The whole gamut.
Yeah,
the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, literally.
Right. Right.
And you grew up in the middle of the worst of it. You went off and practiced in some of the best of it. You practiced in some of the worst of it.
Right.
And finally, you just said to the United States, enough already.
Well, they made me an offer I couldn't resist in Saskatchewan.
Well, that's nice. That's nice. But so what are you finding are the primary differences? And we just have about 2-3 minutes here. But what are the primary differences between medicine in the United States and Canada?
The amazing thing is that we never talk about coverage. Nobody ever asks about insurance coverage.
Uh-huh.
We don't even consider someone's ability to pay.
You mean when if I walk into a doctor's office in Canada, nobody's asking me for my insurance card?
You put down you give them your health number.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's the last you ever hear of it.
That's the beginning and end of it.
Give them your health number, you walk out. If you don't have a health number, it's so much of a hassle that we don't even bother to bill you.
Really?
We just see you because it's so rare.
You mean if like I'm a visitor from another country.
If you're from the U.S.
Yeah.
And you don't have a health number, we just don't bother.
Yeah.
We just see you and take care of it.
That's incredible.
It is incredible. And it's amazing to not have to worry about people's ability to pay or how is this test going to be covered. Or the other amazing thing is that if I want to admit someone to the hospital, I just do. Nobody questions me. All I have to do is call a number, and they give me a bed, and they're in.
Whereas here in the United States, if you wanted to admit somebody to a hospital?
It's a major negotiation. I have to present them as really sick. I have to beg for the bed. Once they're admitted, somebody from utilization review comes by the next day and says, you've got to discharge this person. They can't stay here. Or in psychiatry, for instance, if 7 days is the most you could ever keep anyone here. Whereas in Canada, I've kept people for 30 days, and nobody cares.
People, presumably, who needed it.
Right.
So is this, now some folks would hear that and say, oh, that must be the insurance industry keeping the American system efficient. What's wrong with that? But the fact of the matter is that Canada delivers health care to all of its citizens at about half the per capita cost that we're delivering health care to all but 46 million of our citizens.
Right. I think I remember in Arizona, when I was there, the uninsured percentage was 43%.
Wow.
In the state of Arizona.
Wow.
And that's not even counting the illegal aliens.
So, bottom line, I'm not seeing all kinds of Canadians running to the United States looking for health care. Do you ever hear stories about that?
No. You hear wealthy Canadians coming to the U.S. to get things quicker.
Plastic surgery.
Plastic surgery. Elective kinds of
But if procedures. I have a heart attack in Canada...
I'm
going to have heart surgery that day or the next day if that's what I need.
Right. That's true.
It's just there's no waiting line.
There's no waiting line.
Yeah.
If you have an emergency, you get taken care of.
Yeah.
I mean, the care is every bit as good as the United States and in many instances better.
Wow.
And the reason it's better is because there's not this mountain of uninsured people who get no care. And so when they come in for care... they're really sick.
Yeah. Makes sense. Makes perfect sense. Louis Melmadrona, MELMADRONA.com, his website. Check out his books and online bookstores, and you can buy them all over. Coyote Medicine, Coyote Wisdom, Coyote Healing, and the new one.
Narrative Medicine.
Narrative Medicine. Louis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's 27 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Good morning, America. Are you anywhere near a parking lot? Because if you are, let me tell you right now, you're in for a war. There's someone waiting to take your parking spot. She's hell on wheels, she's the new big deal, she's America's true sweetheart. Oh, she's the 90-pound suburban housewife, driving in her SUV, talking on her cell phone, oblivious to you and me. Kids in the backseat, watching the little TV. She's the 90-pound suburban housewife, driving in her SUV.
And she's going to a conservative church and voting Republican. That's the scary thing. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, with you. 35 minutes past the hour. The Reverend Dr. C. Welton Gaddy is with us. He leads the national nonpartisan grassroots and educational organizations, the Interfaith Alliance and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, and is also the host on Air America Radio of a new program, State of Belief. Dr. Gaddy, Reverend Gaddy, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you. Good to talk with you again.
So glad to have you here with us. Yes, it's for our listeners to this program, this is the first time you were on my local program last week. And, in fact, here in the studio, it was really nice to meet you. The state of the war for the heart and soul of America, really, let's say the soul of America, because it's being fought as a religious war. I don't think most Americans have any sense of how serious, how dug in, how entrenched, and frankly, how ruthless the folks on what is sometimes euphemistically referred to as the religious Reich or the religious right are. Tell us a little bit about the Christian Reconstructionist movement, the whole attempt to turn America into a theocracy.
Well, Tom, I think we're talking about several different types of people and all clustering around religion as a motivation for what they're doing, when many of them have their eye focused sharply on political power, not on the advancement of religion. There are some religious people who genuinely think that their mission ought to be to Christianize this nation. The Dominionist movement certainly thinks that. They want to take over the machinery of the United States government and use that for advancing their particular brand understanding of religion.
And they're doing some significant things. I mean, one of the more wealthy families in that movement that believes that the Bible should replace the Constitution did produce the initial funding for what is now the second largest voting machine company in the United States. I mean, that you look at that and you go, whoa, what's going on here?
Well, and you see them working every day, chipping away at constitutional guarantees like the guarantee on religious liberty, some efforts to do away with the right to privacy, that there is virtually no aspect of the United States government that these people do not want to capture and change as an instrument in their hands for advancing their cause. Now, I think there are also, and I'm willing to stay with that if you want to, but I think there are also some other people who are operating in the name of religion who are equally dangerous, but in other ways. These are people whose primary motivation is securing more and more political power to advance their own personal and partisan causes. And these people are using religion not because they so much appreciate religion and its institutions, but because they have discovered that religion is good political strategy.
This would be the Bill Frist crowd.
I think that's exactly right. And we saw that. I happened to be in Florida today. I'm sure you likely have talked some about Catherine Harris's statements about church-state separation
yeah.
being a myth. And she represents in the comments that she made to that religious state paper in Florida, she represents the very kind of ideology that in some ways I find even more frightening than that of the Dominionists. The Dominionists are up front in saying they want to take over the nation for their particular religious ideology. People like Catherine Harris are using religion to advance their own particular brand of partisan politics, and sometimes the people who write off the Dominionist as so extreme that they shouldn't pay attention to them go to the ideologues like Catherine Harris and say, yeah, but they just are good people, and they're just trying to use religion to better the life of the nation, when that simply is not the case.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. C. Welton Gaddy, who leads the Interfaith Alliance, the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, and also does a program on Air America Radio, State of Belief. It's interesting, if you look back at the 60s and 70s, and arguably even the early 80s, but particularly the 60s and 70s, which was the high point of the American middle class. It was the middle class in America was wealthier during that point in time than it ever has been in the history of this country. And what they did with the wealth and the leisure time that came with it was they started working for social justice, incorporate women into mainstream business, bring African Americans into the mainstream community, are working against injustice in the workplace, in government, in society in general. Let's try to lift people up. Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in half in just 4 years. And a lot of conservatives looked at that and said, oh, this is terrible. We can't have this. These folks have too much money to spend and too much time on their hands. They're messing up our democracy. We've got a good thing going and they're messing it up. And so they set about to destroy the middle class economically, to disempower them politically. And the irony of this is that when people are disempowered economically and politically, they very often turn to the most fundamentalist of religions. And at the same time these guys set this thing up economically, they also began the mechanism of bringing the demagogues into it. And so now we have people who are the most vulnerable, and they're turning to the religions that are the most exploitative. Am I characterizing this in a way that is resonant to you?
Absolutely. And Tom, what is so ironic and sad about the scenario that you just described, which I happen to endorse, is that these people, in the name of religion, were trying to rid themselves of movements that were doing the most basic work of religion, which is about advancing justice, countering racism, eliminating poverty, feeding the hungry, working for an equitable society, seeing that people have health care. And that is the giveaway, if people will look at it carefully.
Yeah, the fundamental reality is that Jesus was the original liberal, and the right-wingers in Christianity today do not want that known. I mean, you know, for the better part of 700-800 years, the Catholic Church made it a crime, a heretical crime, to read the Bible. And, you know, surprise, surprise, they didn't want people reading the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 25.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have churches that I would argue are twisting and perverting the teachings of Jesus. And not just in Christianity. I mean, you and I can talk about this. We're both Christians, but right across the board. I mean, this is happening in religion after religion. The most conspicuous example is Islam, where people are taking fundamental teachings of a religion that begins with that religious impulse, that looking up to the sky at night and going, oh, you know, that touching at some point in your life of, oh, there's something greater here than me. You know, that religious moment that I believe is a common and shared human experience. And using that for political power, how do we combat that?
Well, I think we have to expose these people for who they are and their agendas for what they are. For example, the people that we've just been describing had to come up with some set of values that they embraced and commended in order to be consistent with a religious tradition. And so they have sought to replace the broad-based common values that you find in virtually every religion in the world. And they've sought to replace those values with four or five values like abortion, stem cell research, vouchers for public for private education, and so forth, as the only values that really matter. And so by the board go anti-racism efforts.
Right. So like Jimmy Carter, you're arguing that we need to be taking back Christianity.
I think
all the other religions as well.
Exactly. And one of the things you and I talked about the other day is the election year program, One Nation, Many Faiths, Vote 2006 of the Interfaith Alliance. What we're trying to do in this election year voter education project is to say, ask the hard questions. Ask them of Democrats. Ask them of Republicans. See whether or not religion is being used as a strategy or whether there is really a motivation that matches, complements the integrity that belongs to religion.
Well said. The Reverend Dr. C. Weldon Gaddy, he leads the national nonpartisan grassroots and educational organizations, the Interfaith Alliance and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation. InterfaithAlliance.org, I believe, is the website. And he's also the host of State of Belief on Air America Radio. Dr. Gaddy, thank you for being with us.
Hope to talk to you again.
Me too.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my scars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my country back. We had a bundle in a treasury drawer. More than there had ever been before. But every day we're drowning deeper in debt. Makes you wonder where those tax dollars went. Now my state is red and my collar's blue. Yellow ribbon on the tailgate of my Ford. It says support the troops and Lord knows I do. Let's bring them home before we lose one more. I'm taking my country.
Ah, yes, my friends, it's time to take our country back. 51 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Larry in Seattle on the line. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. I've got a quick comment on Iranian President Ahmadinejad's challenge to Bush to debate him. But first, if you could get your notebook out and jot down the Ohio Secretary of State has decided to delay the destruction of the ballots from the 2004
yes,
election.
Yes, I have that. It's in the New York Times today.
Yes.
He says he doesn't have to, but he's going to for a little while.
Right.
An undetermined period of time.
Right.
We'll see.
But on the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad's challenge to Bush, we're in the Washington Post, it's reporting that Jimmy Carter has agreed in principle to host Iranian ex-president Khatami at the Carter Center for discussions with him. And that, I believe, is a symbolic shot across the current administration's bow because when Ambassador Bolton was in a press conference a couple of days ago, he was asked whether or not he would talk to, or the United States would talk to Syria or Iran, and his flat one-word response was no. And it seems to me that if Carter, who was humiliated for 444 days as president by the Iranians holding our hostages in Tehran, now he's going to talk to Khatami, because Khatami is famous for his desire to dialogue. It seems to me that definite shot across the administration's bow. Hey,
I wonder if his first question is going to be, did you guys hang out of those hostages because George Bush and Bill Casey and Ron Reagan asked you to?
Exactly.
That would be interesting. That would be interesting, because I know Jimmy Carter. Now, you know, at this point in time, he knows what happened. I mean, he's had enough time to figure it out.
He's got all that back channel information.
Well, he's even made reference to it in public. You know, that the election wasn't on the up and up because of the hostages, and so it be that's. Do you know when that's going to happen, Larry?
According to this, Tommy's supposed to be here tomorrow, and I believe September the 7th is when they just want to make that discussion.
Be interesting. Okay. Thanks a lot for the heads up. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Dan on the line. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
A couple of things on Rumsfeld, since that's kind of blown by the wayside, all of his comments. You know, I'm
trying to redefine fascism here.
Well, Dan. I was thinking that what he was trying to do is take the heat off the fact that Bush was being subpoenaed on that day. That's my theory.
Oh, you mean in Portland?
Well, yeah, when Rumsfeld made that speech, I mean, Bush was being subpoenaed that day. And I was thinking that it was some sort of a deflection maneuver, which they're so good at.
Yeah, that makes sense, too. Yeah, they are good at it. In fact, I wrote a piece about it in Common Dreams yesterday about how, in my opinion, the Department of Homeland Security leaned on the Boulder prosecutor to get JonBenet Ramsey's supposed killer into the news the same day that Judge Anna Diggs Taylor ruled that George W. Bush had committed a crime that he could go to jail for 60 years over. You know, 30 different violations, five years each. I mean, $10,000 fine, 5 years each. I mean, go to jail for 30 years, 60 violations. In any case, and was certainly impeachable as well.
I got another thing on Rumsfeld's world. For him calling, you know, our side the appeasers, I mean, in Rumsfeld's world, what we should have done was invade Canada the same day that Hitler invaded Poland.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to know who the Hitler is in Iraq that Rumsfeld thinks he's fighting against.
I mean, Hitler was a grave menace to the world. Everybody knew that.
Well, except the Republicans.
Anybody but his neighbors.
Yeah, the Republicans didn't know that, though, about Hitler. I mean, they were out there aggressively trying to prevent Roosevelt from entering the war. They were really aggressively working against that.
And
the Republicans
now,
so.
Saddam was no Hitler.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And well said, Dan. Bobby in Tacoma. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Tom Harbin.
Oh, sorry, Tom. You're a real American.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on the air.
Yeah.
So one of the arguments that we get from the right wing about socialized health care or, you know, helping young people go to university is it's promoting entitlement mentality, the entitlement society.
Right.
So how are we supposed to, you know, counter that? My answer is it's not about welfare. It's about enriching your own society.
Yeah, my answer is yes, we are entitled to live together as a society, as a culture, to take care of the weakest among us so that the healthiest and strongest among us can build a mighty nation and an industrial power and a democracy, an egalitarian democracy.
And they continue saying, hey, you give them health care, they're going to want a car. So where does it end?
Yeah, well, that's just silly on its face. It's just silly on its face. There's just no parallel.
All right. So, thanks for being on the air.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot, Bobby. You give them health care, they're going to want a car. Come on! That's like saying, well, gee, you give the oil companies $1 billion in tax breaks and they're going to want the TV networks. Actually, they do. Or they might. I mean, you got one of the big networks owned by a defense contractor. Well, maybe there is something to this argument. Incredible. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, also known as Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. John Gideon is with us. He's the executive director for Voters Unite, votersunite.org, the website. He's the information manager of Vote Trust USA, regular blogger over at Brad Blog. And John, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me back again.
Always glad to have you on. You guys are doing great work.
Thank you.
Some information here on Proposition 200, and there are a few things that I have on the list of our original list of things that I wanted to talk with you about. But first, I'm curious about your take on this case where the state judge in California said that he does not have the jurisdiction to set aside the swearing in of Mr. Bilray, because Dennis Hastert did it, even before the election was certified.
Yeah, essentially, Brian Bilbray was sworn in on the floor of the House of Representatives, and it was done based on a memo, apparently, from an Assistant Secretary of State in California, Susan Lapsley, who essentially said that he was elected. Of course, this was many days before the actual certification of the election took place, which at that point is he really considered to be elected. But apparently, because Susan Lapsley misinformed Denny Hastert, and they went ahead and swore Bill Bray in, apparently the rules or the law says that once he's sworn in, he is in fact a congressman at that point, and that the House
and
of Representatives.
And the only way you can undo that is by impeachment.
Yes, apparently. Yeah.
So essentially, what the judge is saying is that he, first of all, it sounds like Denny Hastert was operating actually in good faith here.
Well, who knows what went on between Hastert. If Hastert asked the Secretary of State's office to give him something just so he could do this real quick.
Oh, yeah, we're all Republicans here. I forgot.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just kind of depends upon, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Yeah. So the legal reasoning of the judge, though, seems like it probably was solid, and which means that the challenge in the future is to prevent secretaries of state or people on their staffs from doing this. I mean, do you have any sense of how many states in the United States have secretaries of state who are partisan, as opposed to secretaries of state who are professional civil servants?
Realistically, I would say that they're all partisan one way or the other. However, to answer your question, no, I don't. And I would guess that a small minority are actually civil servants who are hired. I think the same thing goes through with county election officials.
I was going to say just at least those who are the head of the elections for the state.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay. Proposition 200 is Arizona. Arizona Proposition 200. Voters approved in 2004. Everyone wants to vote at the polls. Must show two kinds of ID.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
What's the deal here?
Well, it's just another Arizona being a red state. It's just another way to keep down the people and make sure that the Democratic demographics are not able to get to the polls and vote without a hell of a lot of problems.
Make it harder for the young to vote, make it harder for the elderly to vote, make it harder for African Americans to vote, make it harder for Native Americans to vote,
right
across the board. Yeah, okay.
That's right. And in fact, they ended up hurting a lot of people because the way their law was written, it made it so that a woman who had been married had to go back and find identification, her marriage license or whatever, because now she's got, you know, a maiden name, second last name, and she had to prove that she was, in fact, married, and that's why the name change took place.
Hmm. I'll bet a lot of people are scrambling to get passports right now as their second form of federal ID. Or
I would, yes. I've got mine in for renewal right now, as a matter of fact.
You live in Arizona?
Oh, no. No, I'm in Washington State.
I see. I see, So, John Gideon, VotersUnite.org, what are we going to do about this? We've seen Ken Blackwell steal an election in Ohio. It has been outed with a level of publicity and transparency that's breathtaking, and still this guy's not in jail. In fact, he's running for governor. We saw the election stolen in Florida, and a year later, a year and a month later, well, no, it was exactly a year later, in November of 2001, the New York Times, the Washington Post published articles saying, okay, we actually counted all the ballots like the Florida Supreme Court said we had to do, although the U.S. Supreme Court stopped that. And, in fact, by any measure, by any criteria, you know, dimpled Chads, pregnant Chads, intent of voter, not intent of voter, whatever, however you want to measure it, Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush in Florida and therefore was elected president of the United States in 2000. And so we have this, and that was, like, as I said, in the Washington Post and the New York Times, we have this clear evidence that we have an illegitimate president and two elections have been stolen. I would argue the 2002 election was stolen in numerous states. I'm most familiar with Georgia. There's no doubt in my mind that Max Cleland won that election and it was flipped on these machines because the machines have no paper trail whatsoever. It was the first year that state used those machines. How do we guarantee that we have any kind of integrity at all for the election coming up in 70-some-odd days here?
One of the things that can be done and is something that's being taken on by a group, Main Street Moms, better known as the Mob, and True Majority and some other groups, is they are actually recruiting poll workers, but they're also training them as poll watchers. So they'll be working actually for the county, their county as a regular poll worker position, but they're also getting extra training on what to look for problems, anomalies, and so forth. And then.
So we're infiltrating the system.
Pardon me?
Infiltrating the system.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
I
wonder if the Republican Party undertook to do this 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Very possibly.
Yeah.
That's typical that the Democrats are a little bit behind.
Well, and we're doing it out in front in public rather than.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Is VotersUnite.org participating with some of these other groups that VoterDefenseAction.org and so on to try and get people with video cameras into precincts, polling places, counting stations on election day? So that those of us in the media who are going to be on the air on election day can be doing continuous reporting of where there may be problems around the United States?
We're not directly. Voters Unite is pretty much just me. So, my resources are limited, but Vote Trust USA is doing a lot of that work. They are working with other groups and so forth, too.
Yeah, and I understand the Democratic Party is actually trying to organize something like this.
Yes. Yeah, from what I understand.
Over at Democrats.org.
See what happens.
Or DNC.org. Yeah, so John Gideon, what do you see as the biggest issue right now in that we are facing?
Well, I think the biggest news today is definitely what one of your callers talked about a little while ago was the fact that Ohio now has agreed to not destroy the records from the 2004 election, even though legally they can now do that. I was in a email back and forth with Steve Rosenfeld, who was an investigative reporter, used to work for NPR, and they're really excited about the fact that this is going to put them closer to filing a lawsuit. I think they're going to file a lawsuit anyway, just to be on the safe side, to keep all those records there. But they're finding all kinds of all kinds of information that definitely points to problems.
Great. And well, not great. I mean, it's a terrible thing, but it's a good thing that it's being outed, that the information is getting out there. So, and we all need to be talking about this. We need to be pointing people to all these various websites and sharing the information. This is the story of the century. John Gideon, VoteTrustUSA.org, the website. John, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you again.
And keep up the great work.
Thank you.
You're doing marvelous. 16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartmann radio program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
Now listen, I watched the news last night on TV. Another scandal up there in D.C. Jack Abramoff, Dick Cunningham, Tom DeLay. There's a new one most every other day. And you got Halliburton camped out in the lobby, making handshake deals behind closed doors. You better do something fast about the price of gas, cause I've been paying for mine and for yours. I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, my friends, we're taking our country back. We're doing it one congressional district at a time all across the United States, finding good progressive candidates and doing everything we can to help them out. Today we have Phil Dunkelbarger with us, dunkdem.org, his website, dunkdem.org. He's running for the United States Congress in Massachusetts' 9th District. Phil, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Tom.
Tell me, where is Massachusetts 9th District?
Well, it's a gerrymandered beauty that was created originally to get rid of Barney Frank that runs from Beacon Hill in Boston all the way along the waterfront and includes a number of urban communities, Dorchester, Braintree, and then hits a lot of suburban communities. Going down south of Boston includes the city of Brockton and almost gets to the coast down on the south shore of Massachusetts.
Sounds like a lot of money. Sounds like it was designed to be a Republican district.
Actually, it was designed. It is the most concentrated Irish Catholic Democratic district in the entire United States.
Oh, interesting. So what they did is they split the Democrats off from Barney Frank's district, so that Barney Frank was stuck with the
No, actually, Massachusetts is, you're probably familiar, is a very Democratic state, and this was just an insider deal to try to get a South Shore state senator the congressional seat. So they tried to put Newton, where Barney comes from, in with New Bedford and Fall River down.
I see.
And Barney went down and charmed them all and took the whole pie anyway.
There you go. So who's the incumbent right now?
The incumbent is a Republican by the name
Lynch,
Stephen
isn't it?
Lynch.
Yeah. Okay. And he supports the Iraq War and
like nobody else.
Yeah, but he's a Democrat.
He calls himself a Democrat.
So you're running in the Democratic primary. You're trying to do a Ned Lamont here.
Yeah, this is really a carbon copy. Actually, this is chapter two. Lamont Lieberman was in August, and Dunkelbarger Lynch is in September. And I don't know of how many Democrat on Democratic races there are like this elsewhere in the country, but we're hoping to contribute to the process here of sending a real strong message to the rest of the Democrats nationally that rank and file Democrats have really had enough of the invertebrate, Democratic posture.
Well, they're not really invertebrates. I mean, they're standing up for things. They're standing up for free trade agreements that hand money off to multinational corporations and screw American workers. They're standing up for offshoring that makes more money for the very wealthy and screws the American workers.
I don't know if we need to get into semantics, Tom. What's standing up and what's rolling over, but
you understand the point. We're talking with Phil Dunkelbarger. How do you say it? Dunkelbarger?
Dunkelbarger, just like it's spelled, yeah.
Okay, Phil Dunkelbarger. He's running running against the Democratic incumbent Steve Lynch here in the Democratic primary, which will be September 19th in Massachusetts.
Correct.
For who's going to be the, and I'm assuming whoever wins the primary is probably going to be the member of Congress since it's an intensely Democratic district.
That's really the way it goes, yep.
Yeah.
This
so,
is the race.
So what are the issues where Steve Lynch part
company? There's no question but the war is the big issue. And, you know, if anybody visits our website, they'll see that we hit all of the issues, all of the bases. So it's, for us, it's not a single issue campaign, but for the voters in the 9th district, it has become a single issue. It's a referendum on the war, and it's a great opportunity for Massachusetts Democrats to confirm the message that the Connecticut Democrats sent to everybody, that this war's got to end. And Stephen Lynch is in the last Republican stay the course sham vote on June 16th. If you recall, that was the last vote that was taken in the Congress. Stephen Lynch was the only member of the Massachusetts delegation to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Bush and the Republicans and stay the course. So,
holy cow. Holy
cow. Only one.
Yeah, the website, by the way, that you referenced is dunkdem, dunkdem.org. And I noticed over on your website, you say there is a real choice. Your position to Phil Dunkelbarger, your position on the Iraq war, no. Stephen Lynch, the incumbent Democrat's position, yes. Raising the debt limit, your position is no. His position is yes. On the Patriot Act, your position is no. His position is yes. On a woman's right to choose, your position is yes. His is no. And on the Schiavo case, your position is getting the government out of the Schiavo case, and he was in favor of getting the government into the Schiavo case. Now, you said...
Again, he was the only member of the Massachusetts delegation to vote with DeLay and Bush to reinsert the tubes. The
now, you said that you're in the most Catholic district in the area. Is that going to hurt you there?
I don't think so at all. In fact, the vast majority of our campaign organization right into South Boston and Dorchester, we're full of that demographic, and... these are
a lot of Catholics are supporting you in your positions. Phil Dunkelbarger, the dunkdem.org, the website running for the United States Congress in the Massachusetts 9th District, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, she's a 90-pound suburban housewife, driving better SUV, talking on her circle, oblivious to you and me. Kids in the backseat, watching the little TV. She's a 90-pound suburban housewife, driving better SUV.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Good time, I think, now to check out what's happening with the U.S. occupation, ongoing occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the one to fight or to die. And they're alive in the balance.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq, reported on Thursday as of 11:20 Greenwich Mean Time, Dateline Baghdad, a car bomb targeting an Iraqi police patrol killed four police commandos and wounded 11 people, including five policemen. A bomb in eastern Baghdad's Mashtal district went off by a gas station where cars were lining up waiting for petrol. This is incredible. In Ramadi, a former Air Force commander was under toppled leader Saddam Hussein was gunned down in the western city of Ramadi. Lieutenant General Wajin Thir Hainfish was the commander of the Habaniya Air Force Base when Saddam was in power. In Anbar province, a U.S. soldier was killed in action on Wednesday by a roadside bomb explosion. In Fallujah, three people were wounded, including one policeman, when gunmen threw hand grenades at a communications center in central Fallujah. In Baghdad, a convoy of British diplomats and guards was blasted by a roadside bomber in western Baghdad on Thursday, but the British embassy said no one was injured. Iraqi sources, police sources said two people were hurt in the attack in the Mansour district close to the Green Zone. In Baghdad, a car bomb targeting an Iraqi police patrol killed two civilians and wounded nine in the eastern New Baghdad neighborhood on Thursday. In Samarra, Turki al-Dulemi, a civilian judge in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, was found dead in the town of Samarra. He had been kidnapped 4 days ago. In Jebela, one man was killed and eight others wounded when a bomb exploded at a wedding party in the small town of Jebela, 65 miles south of Baghdad, according to police reports. And in Baghdad, eight people were wounded when a roadside bomb struck their minivan in the Mustansiriya district in northern Baghdad. That, the daily update on what's going on in Iraq. Some just incredible stuff in the news out here. I have some clips I want to share with you. Sean Hannity calling for, I'm not sure, suicide bombing? Could it be? Is Sean Hannity calling for suicide bombing? He's saying, it's time for us to die to stop Nancy Pelosi. It's time for us to die to stop Nancy Pelosi. Get this. Sean Hannity, here he is.
This is the moment to say that there are things in life worth fighting and dying for, and one of them is making sure Nancy Pelosi doesn't become the speaker.
Yes, it's worth dying for. Now, last I looked, there weren't many opportunities in politics to go out there and die. Unless, I don't know, maybe Sean thinks that if he joins the Marine Corps and he goes off to Iraq and he gets blown up by an IED, he's died to stop Nancy Pelosi. But doesn't make any sense. I mean, I just don't get it. He continues his rant.
I want to talk to you Republicans out there, both candidates and voters. Here's some unsolicited advice. Ignore the polls, ignore the media, ignore the pundits. It's 70 days to go. The end is not here yet. We still can turn this thing around.
Let's see. Either Sean's been drinking too much coffee or, Limbaugh and Bush, they've been messing with his medications again. It is worth dying for to stop Nancy Pelosi. What is this guy smoking? I mean,
this is the moment to say that there are things in life worth fighting and dying for, and one of them is making sure Nancy Pelosi doesn't become the speaker.
Now, why would that be? Could it be that if the president is impeached, and we just had a federal judge who, by coincidence, just by coincidence, the day that her ruling came down, John Mark Carr was busted in Thailand. But could it be that we had a federal judge, Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit, say that George W. Bush is clearly, indisputably, I believe was the word she used, in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA law. Now, the FISA law says, unambiguously, it's right there in the law. The FISA law says if you're in violation of this law, you go to prison for up to 5 years for every violation. But wait, he's a federal officer. Yes, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act also says that this law has jurisdiction over you if you're a federal officer, if you're an employee of the federal government. In fact, it specifically has jurisdiction over you. So the president is covered. So the day of the arrest of the supposed killer, I mean, now we know the guy's just nuts. But the day of the arrest of the JonBenet killer, in quotes, just happened to be the day, just a coincidence, of course. Don't look behind that screen. Don't notice that Homeland Security was talking to the Boulder prosecutor, that she had to send her investigator over there with what she described as 4 hours advance notice over to Thailand to get this guy rounded up. Just ignore all that stuff. It was just a coincidence The JonBenet Ramsey's killer was, or alleged killer, was busted the same, well, virtually the same hour that Judge Anna Diggs Taylor said George W. Bush was guilty of a felony, a series of felonies for which he could go to prison. And in her ruling, she ruled that he had violated the Constitution, that he had broken the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. Clear violation of the Constitution. A federal judge ruling the president has committed crimes worthy of imprisonment and has violated his oath of office. Keep in mind, his oath of office was that he would protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's all it says. That's it. I mean, the beginning and the end of it. You just read in the Constitution, Article 2, Executive Powers. Section 1, Paragraph 8. Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability... What? What do you think? Head up the military? No. Protect the American people? No. Be the decider? No. That I will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Period. End of sentence. End of paragraph. End of section. The only job that the President of the United States swears under oath he will do is protect the Constitution. And 2 weeks ago, a federal judge ruled decisively that he had not only failed to protect the Constitution, but that he had violated it. Now, the Constitution also provides a remedy for people who violate the Constitution. Impeachment. So why would Sean Hannity be so all fired, worked up about, you know, it's worth dying to stop Nancy Pelosi from being Speaker of the House? Well, because if Bush did this and Cheney did this and they did it together, then they both get impeached. And if they're both impeached, guess who becomes President of the United States? The Speaker of the House. And can you imagine what must be going through that poor, twisted mind of Sean Hannity thinking of Nancy Pelosi, a woman, being Speaker of the House? I mean, he must have a hard time just even getting on or off his private jet. I mean, it's just light. I mean, you could just imagine the phobias that he would develop. There's a woman out there, President of the United States. I can't leave the studio. I mean, you just see it coming. So,
this is the moment to say that there are things in life worth fighting and dying for, and one of them is making sure Nancy Pelosi doesn't become the Speaker.
Because she'll become the President. Because nobody in their right mind can look at what Bush has done, sanctioning torture, rewriting the Constitution of Iraq in violation of the Hague Conventions and the international and the UN all the treaties that define the UN. I mean, the Bush administration has broken so many laws. You have Republicans in the Senate out of Orrin Hatch's office who hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer for a year and used his private correspondence with other Democrats about how the strategies that they were going to use to try and stop and shut down, you know, blow over some of these right-wing crank judicial nominees, leaked this stuff selectively to the Washington Times. You think Valerie Plame was that? These guys have been practicing for a year. And blew up the Democrats' strategy to stop some of these federal judges from getting into office. I mean, they talk about spying without a warrant. And no investigation, no. Bill Frist won't allow it. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paid much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. Big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore.
And welcome back, my friends. Yep, we're screwed! By coincidence, the title of my new book. Check it out. Ah, the shameless plug department. Anyhow, no, we really are. I mean, why did the textile mills go away? Because Bill Clinton thought free trade was such a cool idea. You know, George Bush Sr. was in agreement with him. You had the two of them up there with the crazy old coot Ross Perot. And looking back on it now, we're all going, hey, you know, he wasn't a crazy old coot, was he? Yeah, that global free trade thing. It's free for the corporations and it's very expensive for all the rest of us. By the way, one of the folks in our chat room over at TomHartmann.com sent me a note here. Pointing me to an article in Ross Story. It's actually an Associated Press story. Speaking of Sean Hannity wetting his pants over the idea of, in fear over the idea of Nancy Pelosi becoming Speaker of the House. Former House Speaker, this is from the Associated Press, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich said Wednesday the thought of Democrat Nancy Pelosi becoming the next leader of the House and third in line to the presidency is frightening. Yep. Frightening. Sure enough, it is. He's scared. And I think it's a good thing. Steve in Monterey, California, listening on, KRXA, right?
Thanks, Tom. I'm Steve. I'm calling about the boycott of the Travel Lodge that a Hyatt Corporation is attempting to pull the same trick that the Monterey Travel Lodge has pulled of denying union workers their contract because they won't sign for the insurance.
Hmm.
And we're going to have a march today from the fairgrounds over to the Hyatt to show the Hyatt, you know, how many people we got that don't think, you know, that they should be pushing their little, you know, housekeepers and so forth around.
Great. So all of our listeners, anybody who can listen to the, anybody who's listening to this program right now on KRXA there in Monterey, California, should show up at the fairgrounds at what time, Steve?
4:30, and also San Francisco Hyatt has the same problem. The local Here Unite, which, by the way, Unite Here is the textile workers have joined with the hotel workers because precisely that globalization problem. So
yeah.
We call ourselves Unite Here. You can find us on the web. Local 2 in San Francisco is also having a march. I think it's from the Radisson, but
that's
you have
great.
To go to the web on that.
That's
but 4:30 at the fairgrounds. Moderate.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate the announcement. Michael in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hi there. I'm a clinical bioethicist specializing in chronic pain, and I'll shamelessly plug my textbook coming out next month, Ethical Issues in Pain Management.
Okay.
You had a gentleman on earlier who was talking about the dual health care system and the myth about Canadians.
Yes.
Coming to the United States.
Yeah, Louis Malmedrona, who is an old and dear friend of mine and the author of a number of brilliant books about Native American approach to medicine. Louis, by the way, not only is an MD, he also has a PhD in psychology. He's one of those rare PhD MD guys. Really knows what he's talking about.
Lots of those where I work, fortunately. Mm-hmm. In the area of chronic pain, we know how to treat people who have chronic pain. And that's called multidisciplinary pain programs. Unfortunately, the insurance companies are essentially closing them down right and left. And now, you have to go to Canada to get multidisciplinary chronic pain treatment. And unfortunately, a lot of the best and brightest people who are writing chapters for me in my new textbook on multidisciplinary pain management are leaving this country and becoming expats and going to practice in Canada and England.
That's what Lewis did. I mean, he left practice. He's both a professor of medicine and at a medical school and a practicing physician. And he left the United States to go to Canada because he said the system here is just so screwed up he doesn't want anything to do with it anymore.
Well, I moved from central Pennsylvania out to Seattle to teach and to write, And unfortunately, they've closed down the pain clinics here to the point that there's only one left in Seattle. We had a dozen here 10 years ago.
Now, you said multi-what? Multidystonic?
Multidisciplinary.
Multidisciplinary. Oh, I see. Multidisciplinary.
Meaning you combine.
So you combine things from morphine to hypnosis.
Exactly. Physicians, psychologists, physical and occupational therapists, biofeedback therapists, vocational counselors. And they've been clinically, and they've been empirically found to be very, very
effective and cost efficient.
Which is the incredible thing. But the insurance companies and the hospital administrations rule, and I've written a scathing article and a scathing textbook chapter that has me on the bad list of the insurance industry, to say the least. But I'm going to keep on fighting.
But the simple matter here, Michael, is that we have a health system in the United States that, number one, is not a health system, it's a sickness program, it's a sickness system. There's no incentive to keep people well. There is an incentive for them to be sick, because Bill Frist's daddy makes an extra $1 billion every time a whole bunch of people get cancer. So, number one, we have a sickness system. And secondly, we don't have a system that is directing its first efforts, its first and foremost efforts, toward what's best for the clients. Instead, its first efforts are towards what's going to enhance profit. And it's wrong.
Exactly.
It's wrong.
And we need to stop treating health care as a commodity and look at it as a fundamental human right.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Making it a little bit unpopular among some of my practicing colleagues when they hear me say that, but it is a fundamental human right. It's
we had this on the ballot, or we tried to get it on the ballot here in Oregon as an initiative to say that we were going to amend the Constitution to say that health care is a human right. And the group that was doing it couldn't get enough signatures. It was a real bummer because they did it ethically. You know, instead of getting $1 million from some out-of-town, out-of-state right-wing think tank, as so many of the ballot initiatives end up, in this state and others, you know, Tabor and all this stuff. Instead, it was a local grassroots thing, and so they just did, it's tough. It's really tough, but that's what we need to do. We need to amend our constitutions and say health care is a right. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders and Steve Malloy. I'll be back. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.